expansion was considered.
At the outset?
Yes. And second, there were two bits put in there, two extra bits to, I'm not sure I'm up to 22 yet, but in any case, there were two bits in there for doing other things.
Just slight spare.
Yes. One of the things that was considered in the 1140, the next machine I was involved in, was having the interrupt cycle do different things rather than just interrupt. You would send control signals out on it. And I think on the 40 we also put memory. Now, did it go on the bus?
Yes.
All right. There was memory parity, but it was not bus parity. What it is the memory was able to respond with a parity signal along one of those unused lines.
But 17 and 18, weren't they parity?
They were parity, but they were never used as bus parity.
Okay.
The only way I remember is
the... I remember those designated as parity, but I don't know if they were used.
Well, I remember that because to the best of my knowledge, the 40 had to have one ECO, and that ECO dealt with the fact that we added memory parity. Let's see, we shipped on, I think, August 34th or 5th.
Yeah.
About 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, I think it was, we shipped the machine. And I remember by February, we had a memory parity system in place, and we only had ECO 1 module. And what really only dealt with the fact that the memory was correct. It didn't deal with the fact you had transmitted on the bus correctly. That was it. Now, Rick asked an interesting question. How many peripherals were there for the PDP-11?
We should have a lottery. Take guesses.
At FRS?
No. I guess
today.
I'd expand even further to say how many were ours and how many were vendors, outside vendors.
Good Lord.
Because what we had to do was, we had 15 different types of options that we put on, because we had to do 15 interface boards at the different standard the first year, remember? We had the paper punch, we had Tommy's disc, we had the mag tape, it wasn't the 10 mag tape, I don't remember. There was a total of 15 I.O. units that we had, the teletype, a few other ones.
And we ran out of I.O. space fairly soon, fairly quickly.
I remember when they started to layer the vector space, they got more and more intricate in a hurry.
If you started the comm devices, they were the ones that created.
They were the ones that created the multiple.
It's your fault. Right.
Well, he was the chief. You were running this show.
That's right. You were the chief engineer. Remember your title?
That's right.
You were Tom's chief engineer.
He was the architect.
No, Tom did nothing then. He was gadding about then. He had just got over his process engineering job.
Tom designed the DN-11.
Yeah, all my very own self. The DN-11 telephone.
I remember one time he called me over when he had hooked up. He said, I think I've got this going out to California, hook back through, and then coming back. And it ran all night or something like that.
Was this back in the days when he used to drive to work in his canoe?
No. You mentioned it. Last night I was watching Infinite Voyage, which is the show Digital sponsoring. And it showed Switzerland and electric cars. And it sticks in my mind, at the time we were doing the PDP-11, at the bottom end of the bench were these batteries that were being charged for Tom's electric car.
Straight below. Matter of fact, it was right out
there from the men's room. 5-2. As I remember, going in there.
Fall over on your cable there one time.
We put the cable out the window so he could.
I figured that was sort of a handicap spot. It was for a mentally handicapped person to park his car.
It's a good definition.
Well, he was the only one who drove me around in a car doing 50 amps. He says, look, I'm doing 50 amps. I says, Tom, I don't know what that means. And I still don't.
Would you believe I have built another one, electric car in my garage at this very minute?
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah.
Did you see the show last night?
No.
Oh, you?
I was traveling.
You really ought to. They look fantastic. I mean, they look like they're probably fiberglass bodies, very light, very small. I got the impression that the cars were from Italy. They probably were small. And then they were converted to electricity in Switzerland. And some of them even had solar panels on the top.
Yep.
my thing now is, in fact, to make a solar-powered car, but not like the one in Australia, where if the sun goes down, you stop. It's more like you sit it in the parking lot and charge the batteries up all day so you can get home.
Well, this one talked about the fact they actually had parking spots where you rented a space with a electric plug-in, and then you took the train into the city, came back at night, and you had your car at the parking lot.
Well, these cars are so small, though, you could park one in a Boston pothole.
That's not necessarily so small.
I have a question for you. Tell me a little bit about some of who the early customers were. Who were some of the worst? Who were some of the best? What was some of the involvement that you all had to get involved with?
MB Electronics out of Connecticut was one of the first ones. Like Harris? Machine number one or number two. Harris was one of the first
ones. Who was the radiation lab?
Right.
Radiation lab, is that?
From California?
Lawrence Livermore Radiation Lab.
Now, I thought those two guys, the California and the Florida one, were the first two customers.
That's right.
Because
I think we're going to take a trip and fix them, I suppose.
Yeah, they were the New England, they were the New England customers to make our field service easy.
Yeah.
And, not BB and the place at Gilmore where I was the president of
Key Corporation.
That was one
Key
of
Key Data Corporation.
Yeah, Key Data.
And Adams Associates.
Bunkerama.
I worked
there. Bunkerama was another one.
Bunkerama was another one.
Yeah.
So what did these customers want? You have to forgive me because I'm a young screw here, but were they looking for like software applications or just basic black box systems that would help them?
What is his application?
If the customer barely knew the application, he didn't buy the computer.
Yeah. No, well, Harris was typeset, and we had a PDPA typeset.
Yeah, we had, and we did some 11.
I don't think at that point we did.
Yes, we did. That's why I hired into.
Yeah, but 66. Application group, was it a software group?
No, Buzzy Dissett and the guys were doing in the eggs, him and Paul Gardner, remember?
Well, basically, the OEMs have got early machines, right?
Yeah.
And they were doing their own application
work,
and they really used them as a form controller.
Now, who were some? Who really got the discs?
The one right down the street, General Radio, was a very big customer.
Okay.
Teledyne was another big one.
Program data.
So what did the PDP-11 do for those customers that helped create the major amount of momentum that has helped build digital to what we are today?
I think probably for that price range, the ability of that machine to handle peripheral devices, to interrupt, just the I/O capacity of that machine, the memory capacity of that machine, vastly surpassed the PDP-8. When the machine came out, everybody thought it was equivalent to the 8. And it took, about 3 months for everybody to realize it was many times the PDP-8.
Was that also true in relation to the competition?
Yes.
The Nova
could drive two bays of equipment, and we could run, when we did the boosters and all, and after Jim's ECO, we could run a six-bay system and fully load it. And we used to ship a lot of them out at very huge prices in the time of $250,000, which were very big, because the CPU was only 11 too. So we were configuring, in fact, I think I spent, David, 9 months on a book this big. There was something like 642 possible configurations. And the deal was you could squeeze the toothpaste out and cut it anywhere you want, depending on which system unit you were using.
But I remember the first systems we talked about being no more than 2B and a BA11 boxes, and it didn't take much more than a year.
It's all that control, 4K memory. Some of them didn't even have high-speed reader punches on them.
No, they did. The first machines that went out, you had to load the programs.
Yeah, that's what
ASR33. It's in the book. There.
That's right.
Yeah, if you look in the system manual, the rim loader is in there.
Yeah. Well, we actually had an option of the month club for a while. And I think for the first year, 18 months, we put out an option a month.
Right. Now, the other thing we did there...
Yeah, we went from two boxes to six cabinets in a year.
I used to get calls from Smith on Sunday morning, at the end of the month, I need $200,000 more. So I yelled downstairs, let the next two or three go out. And Sunday afternoon, we'd be taking six bays or four bays or whatever, and putting it on the truck, telling the plant manager.
And the truck would never move. Just the doors would close and say, it's been shipped.
The option situation sticks in my mind, both what we were doing and what vendors were doing. It's one of my impressions, and let's see, how do I say this? I believe that's the legal defense. I believe that we did not aggressively pursue the Unibus patents as we might have, because we could not produce enough memory for the machine. And it was considered very wise in a business sense to allow vendors to use the PDP-11 interface design in their memories. And in the same way, I think some of our customers would consider the fact that they could acquire some options from vendors. I believe we now call that an open architecture.
Yes.
And also, I believe they felt there was a commitment by the company to continue the bus structure. So when they designed an interface for their application and the new PDP-11 came along, they would be able to utilize that without redesign. In fact, the redesign thing stuck in my mind because Foxborough, for long periods of time, continued not only to not redesign their interface, they wouldn't even redesign their cabinet. And they were buying PDP 1120s because they fit and were on their parts list long into, I think, the 05 34 era, I think.
They were still buying 1115s, 1978.
Yeah. Well, think of the money they saved in software, because each one of those machines had slight personality differences.
No, that's not true.
Three of them. Sorry, John. Three of those machines were alike.
The three that O'Loughlin designed. Yeah, never mind the
lack of creativity or something.
Never mind the rest of them.
Wait a second. John Vizinski, however, did put in a feature on one of the machines. John, you talk to that.
I don't know. Was it jump indirect mode or something?
Yeah, the first 35, not the second one. We did.
No. It was his floating point option.
Yeah.
The 1140. No, that wasn't for the address mode. The floating point thing was that some student at Catholic University, after 5 years of shipping the machine, discovered that if you added a long string of all negative numbers, you came up with error. And my solution was to add them up as positive numbers and change the sign.
Is there any way to differentiate each of the members of the 11 family, the 20s, 04s, 34s, and that's...
Easy way?
Yeah, look at the face panel.
Right.
The first 11, first one came out at PDP 11, and when we were doing the 15, we had to ECO the panel on the front because we called it the 20, yeah. And Steve Tyke and his merry boys were doing the 05, and the 3.5 also.
But what was the difference between the... PDP
11 was the first quad machine, wasn't it? First quad port.
Oh, absolutely.
And the 05 was the first hex.
Being the first quad machine.
Yeah. You're right.
It was the first dedicated logic machine where the connectivity of the actual machine was moved into the modules off of the backplane.
That's right.
So therefore, like some of the other machines had an accumulator board maybe, or two or three of them, the actual logic interconnect in the machine was in the backplane. And if you did an ECO, you changed wire rack. Field service or manufacturing very uptight about ECOs on this type of machine where you put it in the edge. And we worked out a compromise. Roger Katie did. And that was, we agreed that we would never have more than so many wires per square inch in a module.
And then we'd relay it out.
Well, no, but it took some, you used to run wires way the hell out of that square inch or back end, to make sure you didn't move on.
I think we had to plan for UCLs that way.
We had to relay out one board. I think it was timing and control. We junked that one and relayed it out finally. But the other ones brought to the company the Elegance Green Wires.
That would Elegance and Green Wires.
Right.
That a little glue to keep them from flying.
I guess it depends where you're looking at it. On the front, panel.
We probably, I'm not sure, was that a separate job classification in manufacturing?
Yeah, we got it. We all built for different
Paid Incorporated.
Different applications, or yeah, just a different version of
the basically, the machines, each one was higher in performance, and smaller and lighter. I mean, sometimes we kind of leveled off and got a little bit cheaper at the same performance.
But there was two real type machines. It was an OEM machine, which is the 1115, to the end user machine, which is the 1120.
Well, that was a marketing thing.
No arguments, but they were still, you know, they were still delineations.
And then the 45 was the first big system. And the 40 was, we were doing the 35 and the 40, we couldn't do both of them, and we found out that 80% of the PDP 1120 shipped in two boxes, so we said it makes sense to do the 40 before the 35, because 80% of them ship, and it was little things like that. And the 05 and the 3 were just cheaper machines that wouldn't run as far, so depending on how many peripherals you wanted to put it on, we had different different levels of machine.
So how long did it take to develop the PDP 11 series from just an idea to actually being a solid revenue stream? And I guess as part of the question too is, when did you all start feeling the goosebumps about you were really onto something big? Tell me a bit about those goosebumps.
I think some of us knew halfway through the design that we had a very good machine. But also, I think we low profiled it because of the same political stuff that goes on here now.
Okay.
I don't think we told the tin world too clearly what was going on.
Well, I didn't tell the time that we killed the DCM, we killed the first 11, and then they made the trip to Pittsburgh, and they came back with the idea about the unibus and all the rest. I don't remember the exact time.
The DCM, the first 11?
The DCM was
the second 11, because remember Bev Williams and Hamill and them guys, and then we took over, we're going to do the DCM, then they called the next one an 11.
Okay.
But the
DCM and then the 11 you came out with was after Harold had his idea, where you guys made put in your patents. The one that you, Jansen, and Harold did. Because that's when we started. And then in 13 months, we did two CPUs, we did the box, and we did 15 interface cards in 13 months.
We started the PDP 11 engineering group about February 1st to February 5th, 1969. Because I joined in January 20th, 69. It was about 2 weeks later that I took out the papers with Clay Brinks and made it a real cost.
Yeah, because we split it out from low end engineering.
That's
with
right.
The 8s and the 11s.
It was announced in April of 70.
Yeah, but the question was when did it get to be a big system? When we shipped the first machine.
We shipped the first machine March or April of 1970. 13 months. Yeah. So that
it was 3 months later we knew we were really on it because the orders were coming like mad.
Board of directors.
Why were the orders coming in so bad? Because of Digital's reputation or because the 11 was popular?
Well, it was new. It was the first switchover from the 8-bit machines in the 18.
We also had people out working the field a little bit. Andy had contacts, and
Andy came in when we shipped. Two months before we shipped, Kenny.
What?
2 months, because we promised them he'd ship the Ides of March, and we did March 45th.
That's right.
That's when we shipped.
Did. That's why I'm saying March. I still call it March.
Andy came on board before before we shipped.
Yeah, but not too much. In fact, Mark, if you talk to the personnel guy, Mark
Abbott,
he said, shit, we got Katie for engineering, we got Marcus for marketing, what the hell do we need the other guy for? Yes. Mazarese was still here. Mazarese and a higher neck.
The evolution I remember was
Andy.
I was doing PDP 894.
This is doing damage to our audio system here, guys, because they're picking you up as easily as they're picking them up.
I was doing 8i support and said, hey, I want to be in a new machine. So I got transferred upstairs to the fifth floor where the DCM group was.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not quite sure for how long I reported to Cohen.
Four months, because I came a month after.
Okay. And then afterwards, Katie came in.
That's right.
The DCM machine, which is one of those decisions, was a what we refer to as sort of as, it was almost like you needed four buttons or five buttons on the face panel. And each of the four or five buttons ran one of the particular test programs that we were using as a benchmark. It's almost like you push button one, and a certain instruction set, group of certain instruction sets would come in and run that quickly. Then you push button two and another set of instruction
Keep
sets.
Keep going, Jim. We don't give a shit how it ran.
Okay. Well, finally, the software people had a real thumbs down meeting on Friday. And I think it was Friday.
We had a final irreversible meeting where we decided to go with the DCM on a Friday night.
Good.
And we woke up Monday morning.
Well,
and it was canceled.
In that meantime, it was a good thing Katie had a Visa card or something, a credit card.
Yes.
Because petty cash was closed, but somehow we got tickets to go down to Pittsburgh. I met with Gordon and Wolf.
Wolf.
Saturday and Sunday. Yeah. I thought we stayed over Monday.
You might have.
You did.
Sunday night.
Came back, and I think Katie went in and talked to Mazarese.
Yeah.
And,
what the 11
basically,
was
now. You know, Hal's symmetrical type of addressing mechanism was put forward as the machine.
Yeah, because that's when you put Paul and I on how we're going to get the bus, because then the big deal was how the hell are we going to run the bus.
And Harold went off to work on an 8-bit PDP-11, and I was going to work on the 16-bit PDP-11.
Was the bus unique to digitals?
The Unibus was the first 16. One of that type, yes.
And that was very...
That was one of the four patents that Jim and the guys got.
I was not on the Unibus.
I know, but I'm just saying it's the whole group got four, and it was Jansen, McFarlane, I can't remember the other guy who was on it. Yeah, it was Roger, yeah. And you and somebody else was on the CPU one, and then there was one with a memory one with Hamill, too, and some of you.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. That was the first memory we actually built on our own boards, too, I think.
Yeah.
With a folded, that was a folded stack.
Could have been.
To the best of my knowledge. Like
yeah, because at the same time we bought the RCA memory group over in the Far East. Remember, David?
I think it was in that time frame, but as far as I can tell, we built the boards for the memory for the first time and basically designed the stack layout. And I don't see the two memory guys here today, but
no. But I mean, you had
it's funny.
Hamill invited Hamill. Yeah, Hamill was.
Hamill's out working for the sales department out in.
And what was Peter?
Pete Durant was
the other guy, Pete Hamill were the ones doing the memory.
But Peter laid out the stack
on the
boards, which I think is the first time we did that.
Well, it was a lot nicer. I mean, Jamie was asking about PDP, core memories. And I was telling her that we have a PDP-8 wing up in my laboratory because they were doing some historical display for Andover, and I grabbed hold of a PDP-11. PDP-8, classic, the old one. And that memory was in a black box by, probably about 8 inches by about 6 inches by whatever flip chip height is, four inches.
Of course, stacks paper.
And, it was 12 individual stacks inside of a black metal box.
Yeah.
Hamill and Durant got the machine on what? I thought the memory was what? A double?
A double quad,
yeah.
Double quad, yeah.
Stacked.
Double this, and it had a...
It was folded over.
And instead of a whole PDP-8 wing...
That's right.
They were in a four...
A module a little bigger than this.
I remember something just a little different from the flavor here. Maybe all you architects and people who were inside got all galvanized and thought that this was the greatest thing since sliced bread early on. And it's true, I didn't come along for another few months. I'm not quite sure what precipitated it. But anyway, I got the impression that over that first year, nobody thought it would be a success in the sense that we were always way behind, and way behind the eight ball, way behind our own expectations, and that there was no feeling. Now, again, inside, I know there was some, I remember excitement, kind of, and then hope that it would be true. But I don't remember anybody feeling, what was your word, got goosebumps?
No,
to that I say no way.
On the schedule, Thomas, we did it in 13 months, and Ken's first schedule, when he finally started doing some constructive work, said we were going to do it in 11 months. Am I wrong, Hedberg?
That's right. Sorry.
Yeah, we did it within the time we went. And of course, in them days, 2 months late over 11-month schedule is considered terrible anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Ken used to be in my office once a week to once every 2 weeks, poring over my charts to find out if we were on time or not. And you could always lie. But
Tell me more about the involvement
let me address the best thing since sliced bread feeling that Tom speaks to. My feeling was that after you had reworked the DCM 20 times, anything as clean and as straightforward as the 11 instruction set was beautiful. Yeah. And the other issue, though, I would address is that we weren't low price. Somebody mentioned that we were supposedly, people bought the machine because we were low price. We weren't that low.
We were 11.2, baby, and the 8s were 12,800 for an 8i. Don't tell me we were low.
10,900 was the first system price.
Remember? Yeah, but when we had to add the other stuff, it turned out to be 11.2 was the sell price.
But when we were doing
and it was 12.8 for a PDP 8i.
We knew that the I.O., this machine from its I.O. structure, could handle I.O. devices in a system environment better than anything else we had at that time.
I remember that.
So we knew we had a system machine.
Yeah.
And we knew we didn't have any software for a long time. That was our problem.
I'm not sure about goosebumps, but I think there was a lot of sheer terror because we knew we had something really important. And every now and then we could feel ourselves feeling in jeopardy somehow, and people would just get terrified and somehow rise to the occasion.
Okay, so Tom, following along that idea, what would you say were some of the bigger setbacks and triumphs? In the development of it.
I was a little luckier than most of the folks because I was really, I was still sucking my thumb. I mean, I was really young at the time, I came into the group and I remember looking at this instruction set that Jim says was so beautiful, and I knew it was important because I had just come from the PDP-8 world where the instruction set was made absolutely perfect, intuitively obvious sense, and this made no sense at all. So I knew we were onto something really big because
PDP-8 instructions, instructions, and then everything else. Mode.
But it was intuitively obvious where I looked at this PDP-11 and I said, this is crazy. Only the propeller heads in the other building who write the code will ever figure this out.
One instruction could do 5 or 6 things with a PDP-8, but you want to talk about interesting cases when we found the machine didn't work. Like when you had the Unibus, you had to run it side by side, we put styrofoam between the pieces. I remember when the machine didn't work, and you had to separate the distance between the Unibus.
Right now, one of the things that my group's involved with in working with some of the other engineering groups is signal integrity work using SPICE analysis.
I guess
a real horror show, it might be
crosstalk.
And take that Unibus that we did. All of the stubs on for all the peripherals and see what the waveforms really would look like in SPICE analysis.
But didn't we have to write an ECO for the bus drivers because we found out they weren't working right? Wasn't there?
No, that's when we laid it out on the wide cable. We used the 72 wires for 36 signals because we needed a ground in between to stop all the crosstalk. That was the big one. The other big one was when we couldn't shoehorn it into the 5 1/4 inch box.
Did you feel like throwing the towel?
The head engineer was tear ass of Mr. Neville and I, to say the least, because we couldn't put it in.
We had one of the problems is the chips got faster and faster for driving the Unibus that we started getting crosstalk. And when we first built the machine, it worked fine. And as we went down the line, all of a sudden it stopped working because the chips got faster.
The chips got faster,
the machine stopped working.
No,
I remember
the other thing, John.
They met spec.
The other thing with the bus, you've got to understand. And the concept we were doing a 16-bit PDPA. The PDP-8s weren't running multiple cabinets, nor were they, if I remember some configurations in Westfield, running down the power lines half the length of one of the cores.
That's the only place they could run the cable.
No, I mean, you used to go out there and they'd have a PDP-11.
See, it was your fault, LaForce. You notice that look he
and,
just gave?
And that
environmental testing, that's what we're all about.
That and the cement dust.
There was a case when Velkel came in, all right? We took him out to Westfield.
I vacuumed the floor.
And they saw that the Unibus running along the electric conduit, all right? And that impressed them terribly, that if this machine could run.
That's right.
Along that, that was considered to be, they talked about that for months.
You know, what was that machine? That was a test machine that used to download.
Was it app? One of the
software.
Act.
We're still questioning today the spec of the Unibus.
What spec?
What spec?
That's the question.
No. It got signed off 2 years ago.
Yeah, right. 2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago. It got signed off.
Because we're talking upstairs with Mayfair Systems and daisy chaining, you know, with storage devices. Geez, we ought to go back and find out who did the unibus and what the spec is. And no one could find it.
There wasn't it.
No, it's a deck standard.
Yeah.
There's a deck standard right now. Don Venator can tell you what the number is. Because I don't remember.
He's probably the only one who ever understood it.
And the one who got all of this stuff
Don was
in
on
his notebook was Paul Jansen, because he was the only one who wrote anything down in the group.
No. O'Laughlin did. He had that book under his arm all the time.
But he couldn't write, remember?
You promised me. Like a cross.
You promised me to have that done.
Yeah.
No, I don't have any of those books. They had lawyers to call.
What did they take
for? For the National Semiconductor Suit?
Yeah.
I imagine they got Jansen's books, too.
They never returned them, huh?
I don't have them.
Wow. Maybe they're still in litigation?
Hey, I don't need them. I've got 14 boxes of books.
Again. Wow. I like to talk about the spirit in those days. This may sound corny, but let me say it anyway. It's probably my turn after 20 years to thank the people in this room for the support.